Hey, podcast listeners. This is Anne Althaus, your podcaster, your blogger. I'm here again for the daily look at the blog. It's the first post went up today at 5:11, and it's 3:39. So I have unlike yesterday, I have a huge gap between putting the posts up and reading them on the blog for you, reading them and expanding upon them. I kind of like doing them more closely in order. We'll see how this goes. One thing I've thought of doing is reading the posts as I write them. You know, reading them aloud could go along with rereading them, which is the way I proofread them. I write posts and then I publish them and then I proofread them because I just can't help hitting the publishing button. And I can't take them seriously until they're published. Of course, if you publish them and then there's a typo or two, you feel really, especially a bad typo, you feel bad about that, but it adds a certain amount of excitement. Anyway, I could, so I do reread them quietly. I don't read them out loud. But if I just read them out loud at that point, I'd be getting the podcast done. And maybe I'd be getting some extra ideas that I could write into the post. So that would be a good practice for me. I don't know how well that would work out for you. Maybe having a gap lets me encounter the posts in a new way and think of some new ideas. Also, once you've written all the posts, you might see an arc to the day. You might see how they interrelate to each other. And sometimes when I do the podcast, I do the posts in a different order from the order that I publish them. There might be something to that, putting them together in a different way. This is all just a little insight into my creative practice here on the blog. But let's get on with it and read that post that went up at 5:11 a.m. Rick Schneider. Snyder. You don't say Schneider when it's just spelled S-N-Y-D-E-R. You say it Snyder. Snyder. Not Schneider. Do you know that Schneider is Lenny Bruce's real last name? Schneider? But I'm not going to get sidetracked on to Lenny Bruce, even though I've been reading his autobiography and I think about him sometimes. I have to think about Rick Snyder. Do you even remember him? Is he the bald one? Am I picturing a bald person? He's the ex-governor of Michigan and a Republican. And he said something that was of interest to the Washington Post. And it got published in an article in the Washington Post that was titled, Trump Suffers Twin Defeats in His Effort to Overturn Biden's Victory in Key States. And no, I'm not going to go into the recount challenging the election business again today. Isn't it getting a little old? Is it petering out enough yet? You know, I really think that Trump should have, he looks so petered out and undignified at this point. To people who really hate him, he never looked dignified, but he could have been a better loser. Now he thought he could still pull it out and be a winner, and that would have been a fantastic hero story. But once the loss comes into focus and becomes what you can predict, lose well, win at losing. Anyway, here's what Snyder, the Republican ex-governor of Michigan, said that the Washington Post saw fit to publish. And of course, you know, if the Washington Post is all fit to publish it, that clearly means that he said something. And he said it as a Republican that is going to make Trump look bad. Okay? So here's what he said, but I'm going to turn around and attack Rick Snyder because I don't just publish random attacks on Trump. There's so many of them. That's dumb. There's nothing interesting about that. It's only interesting because you can flip it on Snyder. You know, if you want to write a poem about Snyder, it rhymes with spider. That's a good way to think of it. I'm not saying he's a spider. I'm just saying if you needed to write a limerick or other poem with his name, there's a rhyme, just ask him for it. Here's what the aforementioned Rick Snyder said. Trump is a bully. He's famous in many well-documented instances of asking or doing things that are inappropriate in most people's view. I don't think it would be surprising that he'd do something inappropriate today. And I noted the irony, because he, in criticizing Trump like that, in commenting on the effort to find the votes to win the election like that, he's using the same form of reasoning that Trump is using in his effort to fight to win the election. You know what kind of people we're dealing with here, the kind of thing they do. I wouldn't be surprised if he would do something like the kind of thing everybody knows he does because he's that kind of person. That kind of reasoning? I can't believe dignified, serious people go public and yammer along those lines. That's famously bad evidence. I mean, if you want to make a ruling on the evidence in a trial on following the rules of evidence, you don't allow an argument like that. He's a bad guy. He does a lot of bad things. He's really corrupt. You know, he's the kind of person that would do this sort of thing. So don't you think he did it? That's just terrible reasoning. That should, no adult should go out in public and talk like that. I'm really embarrassed for Rick Snyder. And I also think that Rudy Giuliani looked awful the other day, and he was making arguments like that. Well, everybody knows the Democrats in Philadelphia or in Detroit, they're corrupt and they've been doing bad things for so many years. And right? That's the reasoning. So they probably did it here. I don't know. We could have done it. They were around in the general area, and they might have done this kind of thing. I've had it with people who want to be taken seriously coming forward and making statements about serious matters that require evidence and don't use principles of evidence. I mean, I know the rules of evidence are a higher standard than just the general chit-chat, but when you're making public statements politically and you're getting them quoted in the newspaper and so forth, some standards apply. Don't we have some standards left? It's Trump's fault. Trump destroyed all standards because he's that kind of guy. Okay, now I have a post, and this went up at 5:16. So I guess the other one up at 5:11. This one up at 5:16. Now you know that the basic post took less than 5 minutes to put up, to come up with, but it does have a couple of add-ons. Anyway, now pay attention. The title of this post is The First and Last Sentences of a Washington Post article titled Supreme Court Continues Capital Punishment Trend with Barrett on the Bench. Okay, so I'm going to read you the first sentence of this article, and then I'm going to read you the last sentence. So you see what they put up front, what they put down at the end. First sentence. The Supreme Court continued its trend late Thursday night of allowing federal executions to go forward, with new Justice Amy Coney Barrett participating in her first capital punishment case on the court. Last sentence. Hall and three others drove the teenager to a motel room in Arkansas, where they assaulted her and then beat her with a shovel before she was buried alive. I guess I get the facts in right at the end. I don't know if there were... I'm not sure if this... Washington Post article had comments, but I'll bet if it did have, oh yeah, it did have comments. I'm going to bet even in the Washington Post, if it did have comments, the highest rated comment is going to involve saying these people really did deserve the death, this person deserved the death penalty. Let me see if I can get it to show up. No, it doesn't want to come in. Anyway, that's my experience looking. Well, why doesn't that want to open up? Anyway, that's my experience with articles that try to get your interest in the legal issues having to do with the death penalty. You know, is it equally applied? Are the factors that make it especially heinous and justify the death penalty, are they involved? Oh, no, and I did use these. No, these are going to be on a different subject. This is unusual for a death penalty article that has a real ugly, horrible, especially heinous murder. I amended the post to add, notice the switch to the passive voice in that sentence. They assaulted her and then beat her with a shovel before she was buried alive. I said, who buried her? You know, the most horrific part of this is that she was buried alive. So a person was murdered by, first of all, being raped, beaten with a shovel, and then buried alive. Now, Hall and three others drove the teenager to a motel room in Arkansas where they assaulted her and beat her with a shovel before she was buried alive. There's no person burying her alive. It's just that that's something that happened later in time after the assault and the beating. She was buried alive, was buried alive. Distance yourself from the reality that the people who got the death penalty are people that didn't narrowly get the death penalty. Anyway, the writer of the Washington Post article, Robert Barnes, draws attention to Barrett's religion. So I amended the post again to add something extra from the article. Quote, in 1998, Barrett wrote a law review article titled Catholic Judges in Capital Cases that described the tensions. She suggested judges who felt they could not be impartial because of their faith should recuse, and wrote Catholic judges, if they're faithful to the teaching of their church, are morally precluded from enforcing the death penalty. Questioned about that when she was nominated to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit, Barrett, then a Notre Dame law professor, said she would not be willing to enter an order of execution if she were a trial judge. But it was different for appellate judges considering issues of law in a case of someone already on death row. Now, that might seem like a strange distinction, but I think what's being said there is that there's some judgment and discretion in deciding to give the death penalty. And because the judge is sentencing. And as a Catholic, she could not be the direct cause of the person getting the death penalty. But if you're an appellate judge, you're just deciding whether to intervene or to stand back and allow what the trial judge did to remain what happens. And so that decision, I can stand back and defer to what that judge did. I don't have enough basis for interfering. That's different. And that isn't a violation of her religion. Of course, when you're so one thing would be, do you have to recuse yourself? So if you can't do something because of your religion, then you can still be a good judge because you have the power to recuse yourself. You can let somebody else do it. That was the position that Justice Scalia took about the death penalty. He wrote about that. But that if you don't have to recuse yourself and you can actually vote for doing nothing, for not interfering with what that other judge has done, you don't have the basis of power to stop what the other judge has done. And that there's a distinction there on a religious ground. And so she doesn't recuse. Notice in the Supreme Court, if she or some of the other Catholics were to recuse, it would cause the liberal wing of the court, which now only consists of three judges, but they could end up being the majority. That'd be awfully hard at this point. Anyway, I did look over at the comments back then. And I recognized it when I went back there a moment ago. The highest rated comment is on this subject. Quote, it's interesting how some hypocrites justify their views. As a strong Catholic, it is peculiar how she's comfortable deviating from church doctrine for capital punishment, but is rigid when it comes to an abortion that may save the life of a mother or who has become pregnant through rape or incest. I find hypocrites like Amy Coney Barrett pretty repugnant. And I said, legally, there's no hypocrisy. Both positions, and this is just assuming she were to decide to overrule Roe v. Wade and to take away the right to an abortion that's already in the precedent, that she wouldn't just go with the precedent, say stare decisis, and leave the case law where it is. Let's assume that she would. This commenter is calling her rigid when it comes to abortion, but she hasn't even done an abortion decision yet or said where she would come out in those cases. But even if we assume that she would vote and we judge her level of hypocrisy after this imagined point in the future when she votes to overrule Roe v. Wade, there's no hypocrisy because both positions, allowing the death penalty and allowing abortion to be banned with no right against that, both positions represent judicial restraint, deference to legislative choices. If there were no right to have an abortion, it would be left to legislatures to regulate access to abortions, and judges would merely be allowing those statutes to be enforced. Similarly, the death penalty is available only where statutes provide for it. I understand the enthusiasm among liberals for attacking the new Supreme Court justice, but the hypocrisy charge is unsound, and ironically, it's hypocritical to attack her for not using her religion as a basis for decisions in cases of the death penalty. At the confirmation hearings, she was attacked for seeming as though she might allow her religion to affect her decisions. So either she should, across the board, not allow her religion to affect her decisions, other than to recuse herself and to not make the decision at all, or she should. Should you or shouldn't you? You know, if you allowed your religion to affect your decision, then you could be anti-death penalty and anti-abortion, sort of pro-life all the way across. But the idea that if you don't, but that's saying you should decide cases according to religion. And even there, maybe you could make a distinction. Maybe, I don't know what the, well, I won't talk about that, but I just want to say that as a legal decision, it's not hypocritical for a judge to have a restraint position and to be equal across the board as far as restraint is concerned and to have deference to legislatures. So legislatures, if there were no strong idea about rights with respect to abortion and the death penalty, if there was more deference, less activism, what you would have would be, well, what did the legislature do? Does the legislature have the death penalty? And if so, then it applies the way the statutes say it applies, and we don't change that based on ideas about rights. And with respect to abortion, you do the same thing. You would say, what do the statutes say? Do the statutes want to forbid abortion or forbid some abortions? And if that's what the statutes do, then there's nothing for the judge to do in the name of rights to interfere with that. You just go forward with that. You just allow the legislature to do whatever they want one way or the other. So I don't think that's hypocritical. It's not hypocritical legally. And then the religion question is a legal question too. Do you put your religious values into your legal decisions? I think her answer is no, you don't. And if you're in a situation where morally you feel you need to do something, and the question is, do you put law above your morality? There's the solution to that is quit being a judge or recuse yourself. If you really need to use religion with respect to all of your decisions, if you're that religious, you shouldn't be a judge. Don't be a judge. That's the solution. I think there are a lot of people who, in the way they feel they must behave in life, they count themselves out as someone who could be a judge. Personally, I wouldn't be a judge. I don't want to be a judge. And just as a moral matter, you get connected with all sorts of things. You become a link in a chain of causality, you're involved. If you can't do that in a kind of aloof, hardcore way, and I know that there's an idea that judges should have empathy, but you would have to bring that empathy to a legal framework and have some sort of theory of how that works as law. But if you don't want to be bound to law all the time as you interfere with people's lives on a daily basis, don't be a judge. If you don't want to live like that, don't be a judge. You don't have to be a judge. The best thing you can be is a judge. In law, I chose to be a law professor. I think it's better to be a law professor. But even there, you know, as a law professor, you have to do what is valuable for your students. And maybe you could have a level of morality where you couldn't be a law professor either. Could you be a lawyer, choose your cases well? hard to do that and be a professional lawyer and be super moral across the board about everything. So I think the really, really hardcore moral people are not in the field of law, probably. I don't know these people. Do they exist? I'm just imagining them. Well, let's talk about Kyle Rittenhouse. This post went up at 6:14 today. The Chicago Tribune reports Kyle Rittenhouse was released from jail in Wisconsin on Friday afternoon after his attorneys posted $2 million bail, setting the teenager free as he awaits trial for fatally shooting two men and wounding a third during summer protests in Kenosha, police said. His release came over the objections of family members and lawyers for two of the men he shot. They had asked for higher bail and voiced concerns Rittenhouse would flee, which his lawyers have said he would not. Yeah, why would he flee? He has hope of being found, of being acquitted. Why be a fugitive? You want an acquittal. What good would it do to flee? Flee if you are sure you're going to be convicted. Fleeing is a way to signal. This is me saying all of these extra things. Sorry, I should have said, wait, I got to digress to say something. Anyway, fleeing, you create the look of being a guilty person, or at least believing that the court won't be fair to you. Anyway, the quote I'm trying to read began with, they had asked for higher bail and voiced concerns Rittenhouse would flee, which his lawyers have said he would not. Okay, then I said a bunch of things. The quote continues, the 17-year-old's release was funded by donations sought by his attorneys, who appealed to the political right, where Rittenhouse is popular. Those lawyers are also seeking to overturn President-elect Joe Biden's victory, close quote. I added that extra bit to the quote because I usually try to shorten the quotes, but there I kind of left it a little lengthened because I thought it was kind of wacky that the Chicago Tribune tagged on that extra material. But they also talk about how he got the $2 million bail from the political right. I mean, really, it all kind of does cohere. The idea is that Rittenhouse is a particular character, a kid, a teenager. He had $2 million bail, and he was able to make that bail because he's quote-unquote popular with the political right, and the lawyers who are involved are the same lawyers who are getting involved in the trying to overturn the results of the election as we know them thus far, and as I think they are going to stick. Anyway, some of the commenters, I was going to quote a particular commenter, but I'd have to, in real time, find the post I wanted to quote, and I'm not going to be able to do that. But somebody commented that it looked like they just threw sentences together. Well, let me see. Maybe I could find it. No, I apologize to the commenter who I would have quoted, and would they have listened to this podcast? Maybe not. Oh, you talked about my... Anyway, they thought it looked like the reporter randomly walked through a crowd and written the sentences as they came up as different people spoke. Anyway, the next post, this might be the best post of the day. This is the most important post of the day, this next one. And I had a really good blogging experience with it because of how something came together. My favorite thing that happens in blogging is when you develop the various aspects of the post, something clicks together and reveals. It's like a door opens and reveals something. And in this post, what happened was I noticed that something was used in a slang way. I had to research the slang. And then in doing that, it connected with something else that used the same word and used it in a different way. So a buzzword in one field caused me to focus on the way the buzzword exists in another field, and then these two things came together. To me, that makes blogging magic. Anyway, it's all about this rock, Chamberlain Rock, which is a 12-foot-tall rock on the University of Wisconsin campus in a place I walk by all the time. It's just a rock. Now, one thing I don't like about the rock is the rock has a plaque on it so that it kind of works as a monument. And it's a monument to a professor of geology. So it's in the section of the campus where the geology department would be. And a respected professor was honored by digging up this large rock. What is it, like a 70-ton rock or something like that? And it's it could be just there is a rock. I think it would be better with no plaque, but they like to embed plaques in rocks around here. They kind of work like monuments then. Anyway, post title. The 12-foot-tall Chamberlain Rock, in the news these days as racist, is featured as a climbing destination at Mountain Project. So there's a website called Mountain Project where various climbs are listed, rated, suggested routes for climbing things are suggested. So in the section on UW-Madison campus bouldering, in other words, climbing boulders, this rock was listed. It's categorized as, so what's listed at Mountain Project would be classic, most popular, highest rated climbing routes in this area. So if, let's say you were a rock climber and you were coming to Madison, you might go to this page and try to find things you could climb on campus. And this rock would be one of those things, even though it's only 12 feet tall. It's not like climbing a mountain. And if you look at the post, you can see that 8 people have recorded that they've done the climb. So it, you know, collects information from people. So it's kind of a humor. I mean, it's a real rock, and I take it people really have climbed it and thought about it. But it's just a 12-foot rock, and so there's something sort of humorous about here's a rock you can climb. Or maybe some people climb it and pretend like they're really mountain climbing when they climb this rock. Anyway, the rock, the route is marked, and so I have a nice photograph that I took from that site that has a yellow dotted line showing a route up the rock, because the rock has various features, a sort of a line, places where you can get a toehold, I guess. I guess if you're climbing a thousands of feet on some sort of really large rock face, you have to study it and figure out the route and think about how you're going to get through the steepest parts, where you're going to put your hands and feet and so forth. And so mapping out the route on the rock is an important part of rock climbing, I take it. But it's funny to see the route on the Chamberlain Rock marked. I found that funny. And I went to the page called the Chamberlain Rock East Arete. And somebody in the comments said, this is the first time I've ever seen the word arete, A-R-E-T-E, outside of a crossword puzzle. Arete is one of these words that comes up a lot in a crossword puzzle. You can see why. A-R-E-T-E. It's a very useful set of letters in a good order. You know, it's like Renee and what are the words that are always in crossword puzzles? They keep coming up. So it's at that link, it says, quote, sit, start, and work your way up the arete using holds on both sides of the corner, top out. In my opinion, this is the best problem on this rock. And then the comments over there said, found some more roots on this little boulder, hang below the plaque, and climb and top out on the left corner. If you avoid using your feet on the ledge you started with, it is a bit tougher. V2, V3. If you can also start at the southwest arete of the boulder and traverse right. If you avoid the top ridge until you top out in the center of the boulder, I would rate it as V3. So I guess that those numbers rate how difficult the thing is. But I was particularly interested in this line. In my opinion, this is the best problem on the rock. So notice the word problem is being used in a jargon way. So that was noticed. The best problem on the rock. They're not saying climbing the rock is a problem I could solve in different ways. They're saying that the different ways of going up the rock are problems. And so you look at the rock and you try to find the best problem. So you can see they're using the word problem to mean path. And I looked that up to just see, you know, I had my instinct that the climbers are looking for what they seem to call problems. Ah, yes. In bouldering, and I linked to Wikipedia, in bouldering, a problem is the path you take up the rock. So there's a specialized meaning for problem. And I thought that was so interesting, considering that the attack on the Rock comes from activists on campus who are problematizing the Rock. They're using the word problem in the critical theory way. And so I went to the Wikipedia article on problematization. Let me quote a little from that. Problematization of a term, writing, opinion, ideology, identity, or person, or Rock, is to consider the concrete or existential elements of those involved as challenges, problems that invite the people involved to transform those situations. It is a method of defamiliarization of common sense, close quote. Okay, so this leads into elaborate areas of philosophy and also of political activism. You know, reminds me a little of the Rules for Radicals Alinsky idea that you pick a target, freeze it, and I forget how that continues, but basically you take something and then you just keep harping on it. We've problematized the Rock. So the Rock contains racism. There are elements of racism in the Rock or something like that. We're looking, as we do our theoretical moves around campus, we're looking for something to make a problem out of. And it seems sort of like an intellectual exercise, but then you're actually trying to destroy this Rock. So I said, you can also look at the Rock in a political, so you can look at the Rock as a task of climbing. What's the problem? What's the best problem for bouldering this boulder? But you could also look at the Rock as a problem in the sense of a political, you can also look at the Rock in a political or social justice way and figure out the best problem. What's the best path for making a problem out of this Rock, for including this Rock in our agenda of making the authorities recognize and do something about racism? Well, there's a thing on the campus. It's a big thing, and we can demand that something be done about that. And they did it successfully. They did get the authorities on campus to agree that something has to be done about the Rock, that either it's going to be moved or it's going to be blown up or buried. So the problem that they created was not a route for climbing, but something that requires people to say things about a Rock until the authorities feel that their best route, their path for avoiding criticism, is to get rid of the Rock. The Wisconsin State Journal reports, quote, the 70-ton boulder is officially known as Chamberlain Rock in honor of Thomas Crowder Chamberlain, a geologist and former university president. But the Rock was referred to at least once after it was dug out of the hill as a blank head, so it's the N-word with head after it, which was a commonly used expression in the 1920s to describe any large, dark rock. The campus planning committee unanimously voted last week to recommend to Chancellor Rebecca Blank that the boulder be removed from Observatory Hill. Blank has previously indicated she supports the Rock's removal, though a timeline for removal has not been established. The Wisconsin Black Student Union called for the Rock's removal over the summer. President Nala McWhorter said the Rock is a symbol of the daily injustices that students of color face on a predominantly white campus. This is a huge accomplishment for us, she said on Wednesday. We won't have that constant reminder, that symbol, that we don't belong here, close quote. And I noted that it's just quoting from the article, the Rock was referred to at least once by that name. So all they know, they only have one verified usage of the term, and that was in the Wisconsin State Journal in 1925. Oddly enough, this new Wisconsin State Journal article has the word written out. I put asterisk when I quoted it. But if you go to the link, you'll see they've written it out. It's unclear, here's another quote from the article, it's unclear whether or for how long people on campus referred to that boulder as head rock. And they did it again. They wrote it out. Back to the article. Casey Butcher, the university's public history project director, told the campus planning committee that the Rock's removal presents an opportunity to prioritize students of color and engage in complex conversations. And I said, complex conversations? If we can have complex conversations, why do we need to move ancient boulders? We can talk. We can use words. Let's use words. Let's solve it all. Let's do the whole thing with words. Why can't we use words? Why can't we talk? No, destroying a rock would be the right approach. It's easier to destroy a rock than to have a serious conversation where we actually exchange ideas and come to new realizations and get somewhere. You would think a university would do that, figure out how to use language, how to talk, how to interrelate with other people. But no, they said destroy the rock, and the easiest solution for these intellectuals, so they would, shouldn't they be, these intellectuals of the university, the people who run the university, the easiest answer for them to say, okay, we'll destroy the rock. We have nothing, we have no other way to talk to you. You know, the students have out-talked the teachers. The teachers knuckle under and say, okay. Teacher knuckle rock. That's my idea. Let's change. I say, use language, put a new plaque on the rock. What can it say other than stuff about Professor Chamberlain? You don't want to, there was never a label on the rock that called it Head Rock. Okay. But the teachers have knuckled under, so maybe we could say something disparaging about teachers. That would be appropriate. No, that wouldn't be appropriate, because if the plaque solution is chosen, then the teachers deserve honor for figuring out a way to talk about it and to talk to the students, to have an exchange with the students and a learning experience that gets us to a higher ground. An observatory hill is the highest ground on campus. And then the 12-foot rock on top of observatory hill is the highest, I think it's the highest point on campus if you don't count the buildings. But if you count the landscape, the hill with the rock is the highest point, I think. Maybe it isn't. But it's a high point. Anyway, can't we reach something high in terms of ideas? Shouldn't it be symbolic of ideas that reach a high level? But no. Destroy the rock. Destruction is the solution. Quote, back to the Wisconsin State Journal article, quote, the rock's next destination has yet to be decided. Options include burying the rock at its original resting place, breaking up and disposing of the rock, or moving the rock to the Ice Age Trail, carried by glaciers from perhaps as far north as Canada. The boulder was excavated from the side of Observatory Hill in 1925. Geochronology Professor Brad Singer told the committee the department prefers it to be relocated so instructors can continue using it as a teaching tool. At least put it somewhere where we can still talk about it. This is me talking now. I'm saying at least put it somewhere where we can still talk about it. But if it's anywhere and teachers are talking about it, doesn't the same problem remain that it's making Black students feel unwelcome? It's a conversation piece. And the conversation for the geochronology professor is, let's look at the features of this rock and see how they reveal the age of the rock and where it came from, how it was formed. But for others, it's look at this rock and think about how Black people have been treated in America. That's embedded in this rock. That's there too. And of course, now the story of the Black Students Union getting the authorities to move the rock because of its history will be part of the story, the teaching tool that the rock will be wherever the rock is. We'll have to talk about that. So the rock is more associated with the offensive name than it ever had been before. Except maybe back in 1925. I've been on campus since 1984, and I had never heard of the name, the slur used for the rock, until the Black Students Union brought it up and started attacking the rock. They made the name famous. It wasn't famous before, I don't think. I don't know anyone who knew that, who talked about it that way. Never heard anyone say that. Even as a joke, even in the hipster racism way. You know what they used to call that rock? I never heard that. No one, No one spoke like that. Well, maybe somebody did, but nobody that I ever heard, and I've said I've been here since 1984. Okay, now here's a big complication. Again, quoting from the Wisconsin State Journal article, UW-Madison needs to secure approval from the Wisconsin Historical Society before removal begins, because the rock is located near an effigy mound. The first step requires UW-Madison to submit a request to disturb a cataloged burial site. All Native tribes of Wisconsin are notified during the process, which can take 60 to 90 days and include a 30-day comment period, close quote. So, you see, the campus authorities could say they're for moving the rock, but there's a procedure that is required. And at some point in that procedure, the idea of moving the rock could be opposed. The rock is located near an ancient Indian burial mound, an effigy mound, which means that it's in the shape of some animal or that is an effigy. And the tribes of Wisconsin have to be notified. That gives another cooling off period, 60 to 90 days, maybe all the eventually, and then a 30-day comment period. So it's possible that enough time will elapse in this process that the students who care about the rock will have graduated, and other students who maybe some students will say, we like the rock, we want to be able to climb the rock, keep the rock for us. Or maybe the geochronology students will say, keep the rock for us. We've been studying this rock. It's an important teaching tool. But maybe the more activated political students on campus will switch over to the side of this has more to do with Native Americans than black students. And at some point, maybe the authorities will be like, no, we want to stick with the black students because if the Native tribes of Wisconsin are given too much authority, well, you might wonder why the university has its campus, including ancient burial grounds. Why is the university here at all? So the idea that the Native tribes could save the rock, there's even greater injustices and demands that might lie down that route. So I said, as long as we're going to have complex conversation topics, a complex conversation topic would be, do the Native American tribes of Wisconsin have more moral authority on this question than the Black Students Union? Maybe the politicized students would like to switch over to talking about Native American tribes. And the issue of what the rock was once called, or maybe more than once, but called back in 1925 at least once, is of less significance than this ancient burial ground. Of course, moderates and people who like to leave things the way they are might just say, well, why was the rock moved onto the burial ground in the first place? Was that a respectful thing to do? Maybe the Native tribes would also want the rock removed. But people are like, just leave everything the way it is. And why doesn't everyone just come to agree that it's good for things to stay the way they are? Try convincing students of that once they've become activated. Oh, take your activism and bring it somewhere else. And yet, if the rock is moved because of the student activism, the students aren't going to become less activated. They'll have momentum and they'll be going on to complain about the next thing. And not just complain. Complain's the wrong word. It's make demands to staunchly represent their highly moralistic view and to say that something must be done. And once the university authorities have been rolled once, why wouldn't they roll again? Where will it end? And maybe it'll end when the entire campus is given back to the Native American tribes of Wisconsin. Except that the burial sites are much, much older than the current tribes, and I think represent different people, represent a group of people that are not in the lineage with the current tribes of Wisconsin. Why those people represent those other people is something we could, let's say, have a complex conversation about. Another complex conversation topic. Officials estimate the cost of removal ranges from $30,000 to $75,000. Why don't we talk about, is this the best use for the next $30,000 to $75,000 the university spends on racial harmony? You know, people who are paying tuition and looking at numbers like that might feel like, why are you charging me so much money? How about just giving everybody a tuition break? Why spend that kind of money to remove a rock, which is a nice looking rock that many of the students like, and some of the students would like to climb. Another complex topic is what will go there in the empty space after the rock is removed. Now, I would have thought, oh, you remove the rock, then nothing goes there. You just have the landscape restored. And maybe that would be the most respectful thing to do for the Indian burial mound. But according to the Wisconsin State Journal, quote, after the rock is removed, the Black Student Union's focus will shift to generating ideas for how students of color can reclaim this space, such as installing a piece of art, McWhorter said. So it becomes a way to celebrate instead of having it as an empty space, reminding us of what it once was, she said. So notice, this is me talking now, if the rock is removed, there will be a new empty space. And the empty space will have meaning. The empty space will mean there was once a rock called on this space. And that's how Black people have been made to feel here on campus. So the empty space will still be a reminder. Get rid of this rock because it reminds us of something in the past. And then the empty space will remind us of the thing in the past, that the rock was there. So we need to install a piece of art. We need something. What will that art be? I said, oh no, public art. You know, public art, I've been talking about it on the podcast before, but public art is usually bad. And this would be a requirement of public art that makes this political, instructional, medicinal point. You know, how literal, how abstract, you know, it's the tendency to be something awful. It's just so great. I can't imagine. And you have this rock that will cost all of that money to remove, and then you have to spend another amount of money to get an artist and to build something else, and it's probably not going to be good. I just have zero faith that the piece of artwork that would be put here would be any good at all, would be anything but a bad eyesore. And but the empty space is not good enough. Getting rid of the rock, giving us just the empty space, just get that out of our view. No, we must block your view with art, you know. Oh, I said, if only we could see the artwork before the rock is removed and vote on whether the rock is better than the art. It's unlikely that the artwork will be better than an empty, unobstructed view. And the rock is highly aesthetically pleasing, except for the plaque. So here's my suggestion. Maybe we can have a complex conversation about this. How about just changing the plaque on the rock? Of course, the plaque never said, head. It was always just honoring Professor Chamberlain. Nobody cares about Professor Chamberlain anymore. Get the Professor Chamberlain plaque off the rock. Write something new. How about a conversation about what the plaque could say that would... You know, you want generating ideas for how students of color can reclaim the space? How about write a new plaque? Leave the rock where it is so that you don't get the empty space reminding you of what you destroyed and what you made the university spend so much money destroying. You thought of words, and we'll put a new plaque. We'll put a new plaque on the rock. Isn't that a good idea? Right, don't you believe in words? If you don't believe in words, this whole thing is about a word, the slur. Words are powerful. You're saying that in your criticism of the rock, in your protest, you're saying words are so important. If words are so important, give us some words. Write some new words. Write something new. Don't destroy the rock and don't disrupt the Indian burial ground. The main reason for the students to stick to the demand that the rock be destroyed or carted away is that you have a demonstrable physical result. You demanded, and they acceded to your demand, and that sets you up perfectly for your next demand, which presumably is to take down the statue of Abraham Lincoln. And that's not a joke. That's not a joke. Oh, they'll probably find something against Lincoln. And there is a very nice Lincoln statue in the most honored spot on campus on Bascom Mall. Students pose with this statue when they graduate. They line up every year to get to the statue of Abraham Lincoln and be photographed in their graduation garb at that statue. It's a very important part of just thousands and thousands of students' experience going to school here at the University of Wisconsin. And yet it has already been targeted. It needs to be taken down. It contains racism. See? Once you decide you're going to problematize, you can problematize. You know, this reminds me of a game I used to play with my sons when they were little. You know, heaven help me that I thought of this game and actually played it with my sons, but I did. It was called What If You Had to Argue? And I would think of a proposition that was obviously wrong, but you had to think of arguments. What if you had to argue? What if your life depended on arguing? What if you had to argue that Abraham Lincoln was a racist? You could. If you had to argue, of course you could. The question is, why do you want to do that? But assuming you do, you could. And they already are making that argument. They already are attacking that. And I think the reason to attack it is that it's a conspicuous thing. Like the rock, it's a big thing, and it's right there on campus. So that makes it the best thing to attack. Just like they took the statues down during the protests this summer, up on the Capitol Square, they took down a statue of a young soldier, Christian Haig, who died fighting for the Union, who was an abolitionist. They tore that down. And they tore down a statue of a woman with an outstretched hand that was called Forward. That's our state's motto, Forward. And so she represented sort of progressive values, just very sort of abstractly, going forward. And that was torn down. But if you want to say, what if you had to argue that the young abolitionist who died fighting for abolition of slavery, what if you had to say that a statue of him is racist? What if you had to say that the Forward statue is racist? You can do that. You know, that is one thing you learn to do in the university, especially in certain departments and certain courses. You can do that. You can problematize. But we should, you know, you can also, I think there's a, speaking of Saul Alinsky and Rules for Radicals, I think use their own game against them. So problematize the problematizers. Why don't you? If you can. And if you can't, what good is a university? So the next post, must Hollywood cast an actor with autism to play a character with autism? And this is the difficulty around a movie called Music that the singer Sia is making. And at Twitter, we can see Sia faces a backlash after casting Maddie Ziegler, who is not autistic, as an autistic teen in the movie Music. And I quoted a tweet from a UK journalist named Liam Odell. And he said, Hollywood strikes again with another film where non-disabled actors play disabled roles. Having a neurotypical play an autistic person is offensive enough. Rolling this trailer out at the start of Disability History Month is a kick in the bloody teeth, he said. Now, Sia, who obviously seems like a sensitive person who means well, responded. Here are some of her tweets responding to particular individuals. I'm so confused. The character is based completely on my neuroatypical friend. He found it too stressful being nonverbal, and I made this movie with nothing but love for him and his mother. I've never referred to Music as disabled. Special abilities is what I've always said, and casting someone at her level of functioning was cruel, not kind. So I made the executive decision that we would do our best to lovingly represent the community. I believe this movie is beautiful, will create more good than harm, and if I'm wrong, I'll pay for it for the rest of my life. I had two people on the spectrum advising me at all times. There are 13 people on the spectrum in the movie. And I was particularly struck by the line, if I'm wrong, I'll pay for it for the rest of my life. I mean, I know the feeling of seeing that I've done something wrong and then thinking about it for the rest of my life. I mean, basically, I don't know about you, but I don't forget the things I've done wrong, even arguably wrong, even things that I don't think were wrong, but other people thought were wrong. I mean, I remember them, I review them, you know, I pay for it all the time. I'll suffer for having done something wrong, or even for being thought to have done something wrong. It's such a limiting thing to let that happen. If I'm wrong, I'll pay for it for the rest of my life. So I sort of identify with that feeling that I think she's expressing there. I don't think it's really that useful of a way of thinking to be that susceptible to criticism. So a lot of people in the comments are talking about how aren't people actors? Don't you want people acting? The first comment from Laszlo Spatula is, it must suck to need to have cancer to play a cancer patient. And he also said, luckily, most actresses are whores, so they can play prostitutes, no problem. That was a cheeky comment. Let's see. Yep, people did a lot with those comments. Basically, the idea of acting is that you're pretending to be someone that you're not. I mean, somebody said, who was this one person was saying, wait, let's see if I can find this one, that do you have to... Can an unintelligent actor play an intellectual? That's actually done all of the time, isn't it? I'm not very good at finding comments in the middle of podcasting. I need to make a tab and bring that out before I start trying to talk. I'd do that in real time. Anyway, I have one more post. I know this is a longer podcast today because I got so into that rock. And there were other things, too. And there's one more thing, and this should leave you with a very in a very high place, as high as a 12-foot rock. And this is from an article about the actor Michael J. Fox. Every step is now a friggin' math problem, so I take it slow. And, of course, Michael J. Fox has Parkinson's disease and has had it for quite a long time, for 30 years. He was diagnosed when he was 29, which is very young, and he's 59 now. So from the article, he talked about how it had all been for the best. Parkinson's, he said, had made him quit drinking, which in turn had probably saved his marriage. Being diagnosed at the heartbreakingly young age of 29 had also knocked the ego out of his career ambitions so that he could do smaller things that he was proud of. When Fox was diagnosed, he'd been married for 3 years, and his son Sam was a toddler. At first, he couldn't believe it. There were, he says, some dark days spent lying on the sofa, but after a while, he got bored. Then I came to a place of gratitude. Finding something to be grateful for is what it's about, he said. Optimism is about the promises of the future. Gratitude looks at the present. Fox has retrained his focus from running toward what will be to seeing what is. He and his wife, Tracy Pollan, spent lockdown on Long Island with all their children, Sam, 31, Skylar and Aquina, 25, and Esme, 19. We were always linger-after-dinner people anyway, and now we were lingering and talking about what people were going through, doing jigsaws, Tracy cooking up a storm, everyone there, these wonderful children and this great wife, he says. When Fox says, I can't believe I have this life, he's not referring to the restrictions of Parkinson's. He's talking about his happy home. As limited as I am in some regards, if you'd told me when I was diagnosed that I'd have this life now and do the things that I do, I'd have said, I'll take it. I can move around. It takes some planning, but I can move. I can think. I can communicate. I can express affection. What else do you want? And this post caused some of the commenters to talk about their own experience with Parkinson's. Tommy Duncan said, "I have Parkinson's. I'm grateful mine developed later in life. 29 was way too young for Fox to be inflicted. We all bear a cross of some sort. Some crosses are crappier than others. So far, Parkinson's has left me largely functional on most days. The biggest daily challenge is to overcome the inertia that accompanies feeling like crap. Every day, I feel like the previous day, I played a football game and then got drunk. Once I get going, strenuous exercise, things smooth out." That's an interesting image that can help a person who doesn't know the disease to imagine what it feels like. You wake up in the morning and you feel like the day before you played a football game and then got drunk. And then another commenter, William, said, "I'm in the very early stages of Parkinson's. Jaywalking is no longer an option, and stepping off the curb is a premeditated act. Fortunately, I was always clumsy, so I've had a lifetime to prepare for diminished neural responses. Apparently, if you get it late in life, progress is slow. I'll probably die of something else before it gets really bad, but who knows? It does add a certain amount of drama and foreshadowing to an otherwise banal existence. My sympathies are with him, Michael J. Fox. He has perhaps had a blessed life, but it's also possible he's turning into a performance, demonstrating the Michael J. Fox has perhaps had a blessed life, but it's also possible he's turning in a performance, demonstrating the triumphant human spirit. Whatever works. On the plus side, he got to enjoy a few years as a Hollywood movie star. Parts of his time were undeniably blessed, and there's that." Now, to go back to the article, Michael J. Fox is very clear that the great thing that happened to him in his life was that he found his wife and that they had four children together and that they lived as a family. Speaking of a banal life, that's the most ordinary life. And I think Michael J. Fox was delivering the message that the completely ordinary life, that was the great thing. That's what he feels blessed about. That's what he has the gratitude for. Not for having once had the experience of being a Hollywood star, not for having had some greatness in his life, but the true greatness is in the love of your family.